Manx Radio's 2016 election coverage.
And now on the programme, we speak to another election 2016 candidate. Today, we're joined by 40-year-old Mark Kemp, who's standing in the now two-seat constituency of Rushen. Good afternoon, Mark, and welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon.
First of all, set out your stall and tell people who don't know you a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. Left school in 1994. Got into a career in accountancy. Did that for about 18 years. Worked for some fantastic companies. The last full-time position I held, I think, was at PokerStars, where I was a financial controller. I've had my own company as well for a brief time, which was interesting, to say the least.
Was that an accountancy firm?
That was accountancy bookkeeping, kind of thing, yeah. So it was helping people who, where their company was kind of falling over, get them back on their feet, that kind of thing. But what I really wanted to do when I left school was actually be a policeman or a teacher.
Okay.
So what I've done is, before I hit 40, I thought, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to become a teacher. It's what I wanted to do. So I went and did it. I got my degree, got my teaching diploma, started working at the Isle of Man College and QE2. Had a fantastic time there. Last year I was working at Ballacameen High School, teaching business and economics, helping out in the Key Stage 4 office, dealing with pastoral issues, which is a real eye-opener. Helped me a lot. And now, to be honest with you, after 4 years in education, seeing those huge budget cuts, 9 million disappearing in the first few years of the Bell administration, I've thought, do you know what? I'm sick. I've run out of textbooks. I'm sick of laptops breaking and so on. So here I am now, sitting for MHK.
And have you had any political aspirations before now, or is this just based on your recent experience?
It's not political aspirations, no. I've always kept an eye on things, of course. And, you know, I'm interested in what goes on in America, which right now is getting to the point of hilarity.
Yeah, isn't it?
And the UK, I don't know, I can't even begin to comment on what's gone on there. But the Isle of Man has certainly seen a tumultuous time, which has obviously galvanised people to be interested. And in fact, on my Facebook page, I've got a number of my former students from both schools engaging now with politics. That they're loving it. They're really enjoying it. So no aspirations in the past. But obviously, I've always had that sort of social desire to try and help people out, and I feel like I'm not making an, I hate to say the phrase, make a difference, but I feel like I'm not making enough where I am.
You talk about being in a situation where there are fewer textbooks because of budget cuts and laptops breaking down and things like that. Understandable that you, you know, as a teacher or a lecturer, you'd want to maybe redress that situation. But do you not see that the government's in a situation where there's just no money and they've got to save it?
On the face of it, that might be the case. On the face of what's being said, what we're seeing in the budget pink book, perhaps. But really, when you actually think about it, let's get down to the nitty-gritty. Let's talk about budgets for a moment. And without getting too technical, the current process is one where the government take what happened last year and add a bit. That's it. That's the bottom line. That's a simple way of looking at it. We had a situation this year where Minister Gorn decided he had 473,000 left over. So there he goes and relays the slock road. How many teachers is that? How many textbooks is that, to be extreme? But let's bring it back for a moment. What can we do to stop this? Well, let's think about the budget process. There is a two budget process that we can implement. One is zero-based budgeting. This is where we start at zero again every year. And the other one...
So each department's got to bid for a budget?
Kind of, yeah. It's not so much bidding, more sort of putting together a business plan and saying, this is what we need, okay? We start at zero. What are the essentials? We also have priority-based budgeting. And this is where, now, I know Sheila Lowe's put in the pink book that she doesn't like to ring-fence things or won't ring-fence things. I'm only paraphrasing here. But really, we do need to ring-fence the likes of healthcare, education, the police, and so on. So that's where the priority side comes in as well. Now, with the zero-based budgeting, starting at zero again, a report by Deloitte that I've read recently, and several other reports I've read online as well, indicate that zero-based budgeting, the switch from what we do right now, which is just adding a bit, moving to a zero-based, we can save between 10 and 25% of our operating costs each year.
Yeah,
that's what we can do.
But doesn't that mean to say that essential things might get put to one side because, you know, at the start of the financial year, people didn't maybe expect things that have come up?
I wouldn't say essential things be put aside. The priority-based element would actually cater for that. But the big thing is, when we're saying we've got no money, what we need to be thinking is, well, instead of trimming around the edges, and instead of going after the disabled or the elderly, which is what we seem to be doing at the moment, let's go after the largesse, the spending that doesn't need to happen.
Well, in fairness, Alan Bell has been talking for years now about this silo mentality within government. Mm. So this is an example of you know, you're talking about that effectively, aren't you? Which every department's got its own sort of little fiefdom. It does things the way that it's always done them. You would like to change all that completely.
Yeah, absolutely. And that falls in with one of my other policies, which is actually government reform. Now, on the civil service side, yes, we need to stop these silos. We need to get the various departments talking to each other, much like we do with departments or functional areas in a company. Although I'm not saying that we treat government like a company. Yeah. It's two different ways of looking at that. What I'm saying is we need to have synergy between the departments. They need to talk to each other. Now, moving up a tier into what I'm trying to move into, which is Tynwald, there's a lot of reform there. So I don't know if you want to ask me about that.
Well, before we get to that, isn't there an institutional reluctance for government to work in a joined-up way? Because, again, you know, the last two or three administrations have wanted joined-up government, and they've all been aiming for it, but not seemed to get very far. So, I mean, is this something that the civil servants and the public sector workers are reluctant to embrace?
I would say they would be. Now, I'm not saying that people aren't doing their jobs to a very good level. I'm not saying they're not working hard. But if we think about things like staffing, for example, I think it was in 2010 we had circa 8,000 government employees. Now, the cost for employees has gone up from 316 million to 348 million in that time. Now, at an INSEP meeting that I had, which is teacher training, a member of the Cabinet Office came in and said we were up to about 9,500 government employees. If you look at the numbers, that 32 million difference, when we're supposed to be cutting back, that equates to around 1,000 more employees when we're supposed to be cutting back.
Right.
So I'll bet you people don't want to cut back. I'll bet you they are protecting their fiefdoms.
All right. You're very critical of the present administration. Isn't it a little conceited that you think you could do better? No political experience at all. I mean, certainly a great background in teaching and accountancy. But, you know, do you actually think that you can make that sort of difference if you're elected?
100% I believe I can make the difference. However, what I would say is, I can see where you're coming from with the conceited element, and I can see why other people might think that. They might be listening now and thinking, who is this guy? But I do have a good background in accountancy. I've been a company director, I've been a teacher, I've worked within government, I've seen how things operate. I've got a wide network on the island as well. And I've got a good skill set. I can bring that to the fore. Yes, I don't currently have political experience, but I'm not going for the chief minister's position. I'm going for MHK.
The worry that I've got when I talk to people who are standing for election who say things like that is that, you know, you've got experience as a company director, as a top accountant, but that's a hierarchical sort of a structure whereby you rise to a certain position through, you know, your experience and your skill set, and people have got to listen to you. If you're elected as an MHK, nobody's got to listen to you, really, have they? You know, you've got to carry along 24 other members.
What I would say about that is, and it's one of the things I've actually taught in my business lessons, the different methods of hierarchies within companies. Now, you can have autocratic, which is what I feel the Council of Ministers and the Bell Administration is all about. Or we can have democratic, which is where we all listen to each other. And as an MHK, you don't actually have, if you become a member of a department, you don't have to devolve your powers. You can hang on to those. And I feel I can actually make a very positive impact if I was a departmental member.
Okay. There's a good word for that, which is interdependence. You're not independent, you're not dependent, but it's a case of people working together to achieve a common goal. Do you think that the current administration has just really not quite grasped that?
Yeah, I do feel they haven't grasped it. However, there are members within this current government who I have a very high regard for. So I take your point before, maybe on the face of it, I look like I'm a little bit critical of government. As a taxpayer, I think I have a right to be at times. But when I look at who's in there at the moment, who I hope will come back, I think there's a lot of hope for the future. We've got some great candidates out there as well.
Do you not think it's going to be a scary time in that we're going to have, you know, probably a lot of new members with no political experience at all? Isn't it going to take 12 months for everybody to find the way to the loos, for example?
I would hope not. I would hope that we're going to vote in people who can hit the ground running. That's what we need.
OK. Where do you stand on pensions? That's, I don't know if this is what you've been finding on the doorstep, but a lot of people that talk to me are really worried about this pension shortfall. What would you do about the deficit?
OK. From walking around and meeting people, it is a concern. They're all worried about what's going to happen with the pensions, and the main concern seems to be, will the money be there? So is there going to be a national insurance reserve? Is there going to be a public sector pension reserve? Are they going to be there? Sorry, called the national insurance one. It's actually a fund, isn't it?
Right.
So we know that the money is there at the moment. There is money. We know that if we continue to pay into it, we can continue to meet our current liabilities. But we know that down the road, there's going to be a problem. And I'm talking about the public sector at the moment. So we need a raft of reforms and we need to bring them in parts. We can't just suddenly take new starters out of the scheme and so on. It's going to create an issue where we can't actually meet our existing liabilities.
So no quick fix then, you don't think?
Definitely no quick fix.
Because the government is saying that it took decades to get into this trouble, it's going to take decades to get out. Other people say, hang on a minute, we can't wait that long, because an awful lot of the fix over the next number of decades is predicated on things like, you know, growth in the economy, which is not a guaranteed given, is it?
Well, the growth in the economy certainly isn't a given, and I don't want to think that it's going to take decades to dig us out of this hole, because by that point, we're almost bust. We can't have that. So going back to my earlier point about the way we changed the budget process, if there is 10 at the lower end, 10% of savings there, that's 50 million we can put back into the pension pots, or some of that can go towards our healthcare. Now, there are other reforms we can bring in, such as capping the lump sum at a lower level. This is for people with about 15 years to retirement. It seems incorrect to penalise people who are on the cusp of retiring, so we've got to pull back a little bit.
Well, surely it's unfair to anybody who's a part of this scheme, isn't it, to say, you know, we did say that this is what you're going to get at the end of the period, you're not anymore. I mean, that's not fair to people, surely.
No, it isn't fair. I will agree with that, but what we've got to do is, all of us, we just have to be realistic. Would you rather have something rather than nothing? So we need a raft of reforms. We bring them in increments. We can actually preserve the pot that we have, or try to, and we can start building. So the budget reform, we've got the reforms for the pension itself, but then let's also look outside. I'm looking out the window here, and we've got the Irish Sea there. Now, off our east coast, we apparently have £1.5 billion of gas reserves.
Right.
We can tap that. Now, in a report I read, they were saying it could take 10 to 20 years, and it's £100 million pounds worth of revenue to the Manx government if we can get through the sandstone and extract it. I don't see why we should adopt the UK licensing policy, which will only give us about a 30% tax take. If we adopted more of a Norwegian take on it, we could be, I'm not saying we go for 78%, but we could be claiming a lot more money. Plus, we have on our doorstep, we have all this wind. We've got Dong Energy, who want to lease our seabed. Now, we don't have to just lease the seabed to them. We can take a share of their profits.
But do you not get to a situation where companies like Dong would turn around and say, you know, we're not going to build the wind turbines, we're not going to drill for these gas reserves, because effectively you want too much of the pie?
That's if we start making unreasonable demands. But, you know, if natural resources are failing, if they're being depleted, people are going to want what we've got. Wind is abundant. There's many, many startups out there. If Dong decide we're being unreasonable for whatever reason, well, let's invite in one of these brand new startups, one of these fantastic companies.
Let's look at other areas then. You say that tourism's been neglected. In what way has tourism been neglected? Do you think we've gone for too many niche areas? Or
I think, yeah, we have been a little bit niche in some of our offerings, but also what we're doing is we're spending money on these grandiose paving stones. And that's costing an absolute fortune. I'm sure you're sick of hearing this by now, but you know, there's a lot of money going on these things. If you look at Castown Square, it's an absolute mess. You know, everyone's nearly colliding with each other when they're trying to get out of there. And we're spending all this money on regeneration, which I agree with regeneration, but are we spending it in the wrong areas? why aren't we thinking about what we're supposed to be doing with tourism? We've got a beautiful island, we've got waterfalls, we've got roving countryside. We could promote glamping. We could be looking at our travel links. Let's try and exploit those a bit more, make them a bit more competitive.
Well, you've got no control as a politician over our transport links. You know, we've got an open skies policy and we've got a locked-in steam packet for the next X number of years. So as a politician, you can't influence that, can you?
I think you can always influence things. You can always start. It might be a slow process, but if you do your research and if you speak to the right people, you can change agreements.
All right. You say that money could be put aside for innovation. Isn't that what the £50 million Economic Development Fund is?
I don't think it's there purely for innovation. It's there for business incubation, innovation, existing companies, trying to encourage inward investment, people to set up over here. In principle, I think the EDF is fantastic. However, I think it is 5 years too late, really. But now we've got it, let's try and make the best of it.
Okay. You'd like to see more foreign investment in the island, buying up land in Douglas, for example. Wouldn't that set an awful lot of people against you, in that people don't want to sell the birthright to foreign investors necessarily?
I think we have to recognise that we do have land and we do have buildings on this land that are just lying there dormant. We also have some land at the end of the promenade, for example, and that's just been left for years and years and years, and we should be doing something about it.
But isn't that because they can't get a private developer to come in and build somewhere, and it doesn't cost the government any money to do? I'm sure government could throw 50 million quid at the site tomorrow and build a fantastic facility, but it would probably never pay for itself. So, you know, can you not understand that these things that government would like to do rely very much on the private sector?
They do rely on the private sector, and I accept that you can't just throw money at things. Completely agree with that. However, we're going back to this comment, on the face of it, no, they can't get a developer. But is that the truth? I don't know. None of us know, because we're not currently in the upper echelons of government. But there must be a way we can get somebody to develop that site. Now, as a quite a radical idea, I'm not saying we have to do this, it's just a radical idea. We could perhaps build a hotel and casino on that site. I mean, they pay for themselves in tax revenues as far as I'm concerned. Yes, there are problems, some social problems that come with these things, and I'm not saying we should do it, I'm just saying as an idea, there's an idea. There's other things we could be doing. I just want to see.
But aren't all those things going to take money away from buying textbooks and laptops for the kids?
Not if it's private investment.
Okay. You say that the island's underperforming as a nation. Surely not. I mean, given our neighbouring jurisdictions, we've actually done better through the recession than any of them, haven't we?
Well, I think when you look at what Mr. Bell and Mr. Tier are constantly trumpeting, which is X amount of years of unbroken economic growth, we come back to this comment again. On the face of it, yes, we look like we're doing okay, because our gross domestic product is going up year after year. Now, that's a good thing. That's something to be celebrated, no question. But if we think about that for a moment, how happy are we all as homeowners, car owners, people who walk down the street, people who go out for a night out? How happy are we?
Do you think that the way that we measure this is wrong?
Not so much the way we measure it, but whether we have enough measurements in place. So, for example, there's a thing called the Cantrell ladder, which is a 1 to 10 scale of how happy residents are within an economy. When we look at our GDP and we boast about it, which is a good thing to boast to other nations about, we're not actually thinking how happy and how socially happy and responsible the government's being and so on. And there's other measures like that where we could be looking at those.
But isn't that more money spent on monitoring things rather than actually doing anything? You know, a lot of criticism is laid at politicians for constantly, you know, doing all sorts of surveys and things like that that actually don't change anything.
I think you have to be careful when you say things like, is that more money being spent? Because there are times where it is appropriate to spend money. This is one of them. We need to know if people are happy. If we don't know if people are happy, then we're walking into the dark, aren't we? Now, we've got more for sale signs than I've ever seen in my life up at the moment. We've got companies leaving in droves. Yes, we have got companies coming in at the same time. But how do we know what the real cause is for people leaving the island, or for people not being particularly happy or dissatisfied? Or
isn't it global factors? I mean, can we not just decide that for ourselves, that, you know, as things change, banking crisis 2007, for example, has changed the world as we know it, surely?
it has changed the world. I'd like to see that there's a lot of opportunity in there personally. But we need to look at things on a micro scale, not just a macro scale. We don't just look at things on a global scale. We have to look at what's happening on the island. And are people happy? Now, go back to last year with the unprecedented spate of burglaries that we had? Now, my family are all policemen. I didn't feel safe, to be perfectly honest with you. The door was being locked every night, and we don't normally do that.
That would have been a big change.
Without question, we always do now. But the point is, do you feel safe? Do you feel like you have enough public services? Healthcare is in a real mess. And I know that from going door to door, people aren't happy. So if we look at the cantrell ladder, if we do our surveys, let's start finding out what's making people angry, why they're dissatisfied, and then let's have a look at where that can fit into our budget process.
All right. Well, one of the things that you say about this is that healthcare's in crisis. I mean, people who get in touch with my programme all say that they've had a fantastic experience. Mm. They were seen reasonably quickly and, can only say nice things about Nobles Hospital, for example. There are cases we know of where things go wrong, but do you really think that healthcare's in crisis?
Yeah, definitely. When you think about... Okay, so you have people phoning up saying what a lovely experience they've had, and that's great. I'm really happy for them. I think that's fantastic. But that's down really to the foot soldiers, isn't it? The nurses. These are the people who cater to our every need, and they're the ones who are under incredible stress in a health service that is absolutely top-heavy with management. We have had how many years now to try and get this right, and we still haven't got it right. We can be looking at the NHS Trust, the UK NHS Trust, to come in and help us with leadership and support. We can be looking at the Care Quality Commission, who can monitor, inspect and regulate things. So we're getting an outside appraisal of what's going on or what's going wrong. We can look at that management. Where can we reposition people, or do we need that many people? Do we need to keep recruiting as we are?
But, you know, with respect, you would be a new politician and you're saying that we need to look at that. Surely there are people within the health service who are charged with doing that, from the health minister down. So are you saying that they're not doing a good enough job?
Well, that'd be putting words in my mouth. What I'm saying is, I think we need to look at it again more closely, and we also need outside sources to look at this as well.
Okay, more outside sources, more. Because we've got people already from the UK looking at it.
What I will caveat, though, is I'm opposed to bringing in consultants for consultants' sake.
Okay.
But where it's needed, I think we can spend money on it, where there's a benefit to be had, a tangible benefit.
Do you think we live in a fair society in the Isle of Man?
No, to be honest. I've worked in the finance sector for a long time, and I personally think the Isle of Man leans towards capitalist tendencies, and I think there is a growing wealth gap on the Isle of Man.
So it's a two-tier society?
Certainly getting that way.
Oh, and how would you redress that? How do you stand on things like the tax cap? Do you think that that's a net benefit to us, you know, even though it might be slightly distasteful for people?
When it's been examined, it looks like the tax cap hasn't been particularly good to us. I've got nothing against high net worths coming in, investing, employing people, regenerating areas, all that kind of thing. That's all benefit to the Isle of Man. And maybe there's a tax cap they can take advantage of, because that's an incentive for them to come in here. But we get a lot more back.
Okay.
Now, if it's just high net worths coming in, living on a hill, and just taking advantage of a tax cap, no, I'm absolutely against it in that case, because there's no benefit to the island then.
Okay, fair dues. You're unhappy about the continued use of reserves, but isn't that why the reserves were set up in the first place, for the rainy days that we've been having?
You could argue that, but let's go back to my first point, which was about budgets. Do we need to be constantly having a go at those reserves?
Okay. You can either save money to get us out of the problems that we've got at the moment, or you can make money. Are there any obvious areas that you think the island is missing in terms of, you know, being able to make some more money?
Well, if we go back to some of the points I've made before, I don't think it's a case of either save or spend, spend our way out of trouble. I don't think it's a case of that at all. I think there's a raft of things we can be doing. Budget reform, government reform, tackling the pension problem, tackling the healthcare problem. But then we look at the gas reserves, the clean energy we have there. We could also be looking at tidal power. There's things we can invest in, or we can encourage companies over here. The EDF should help, I hope. But there's many more things we can do besides, and one of those, is tourism as well.
All right. Do you worry that maybe the House of Keys, as it's constructed at the moment, is just a talking shop where things are kicked around to death, but nothing much is being done?
Good question. I'm going to be blunt. Yes.
Okay, fair dues. We're pretty much out of time, but Mark Kemp, tell the people of Russian why they should vote for you on September the 22nd.
Because I am a man for the people. It's that simple. I will not be bullied or manoeuvred or cajoled. I will stand there and I will represent you. Simple as that.
Candidate for Russian Mark Kemp, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Keep up to date with the latest House of Keys General Election 2016 coverage on manxradio.com.